The views expressed on this podcast are only those of the individuals featured on the show and do not in any way reflect the official policy of the United States government.
You are listening to the Embassy Wealth Podcast. We believe wealth isn't just about finances and money. It includes health, relationships, and anything else that makes you excited to get up in the morning. We interview members of the foreign affairs community to see how they're building wealth, both personally and financially, no matter where they're posted. This is your host, Tanya Salsa. Let's get to today's show. Welcome to the Embassy Wealth Podcast. And today we have Stephen Marquette on with us. Stephen is a DS agent and has been in the service for about 20 years, half of which has been overseas or in high travel assignments. And we're having Stephen on the show today to talk about real estate investments and some other different types of investments, including crypto and multifamily. So, Stephen, welcome to the show. Let's start with your story. How did you get started on all of these investments?
Sure. First off, thanks for having me. So, basically, I am a DS agent, as you mentioned, just shy of 20 years. I've spent probably half of my time overseas or in domestic high TDY jobs. I've done Kabul, Peshawar, Dublin, New York, and DC. And I think my real estate kind of journey or interest really started after I had purchased a condo here in DC in 2006, when I first came to my first DC assignment from New York. And when I went overseas, I saw that obviously without any housing costs, I was, you know, cash positive, and that kind of grew, especially after an original refinancing on that. And then counting in some of the tax benefits, it seemed quite lucrative, especially when somebody else is paying rent in most of my utilities. And so I basically, while overseas in one of these first set of tours, I started looking at a vacation home to add the benefits of some of the tax or the tax benefits of not paying DC taxes in particular. And so I looked at buying a vacation home and ended up partnering with another DS agent and buying a condo in the Mount Washington Valley of New Hampshire, which is an outstanding, great four season location. So it was perfect for whenever anyone was back from home leave or family, friends wanted to use it location wise year round. And so originally we were really only going to kind of let friends and family use it to avoid the wear and tear of a short-term rental. And ultimately, maybe about 5 years ago, we ended up putting it on Airbnb and HomeAway and saw that, you know,
There was a market for it. Yeah,
totally. It was a cash cow in many respects, or at least covered, I should say, all the carrying costs. And we really didn't see much impact from the renters in terms of wear and tear, which was
interesting,
kind of surprising.
Yeah, it is surprising, actually.
Yeah. And so returned in 2013 to DC after a couple tours overseas and found, you know, the housing market was just incredibly hot. And, you know, I was losing at that time probably about a dozen offers and trying to buy.
Some things don't change, unfortunately.
No,
yes.
No, it's probably even worse than it was then.
It's not great, but it's always been competitive in DC, right? And actually, to go back, because you said you first purchased a DC condo in 2006, which, I mean, maybe it wasn't exactly at the height of the market, but it was pretty high up there. I mean, how did that condo do? I mean, it's clearly not too badly if you were wading into the market again in 2013, right?
Yeah, it surprisingly, you know, it never really went into the red, you know, throughout the kind of the collapse. I think that's the benefit of the DC market in particular. It's really sheltered, as you well know. And I think there was always a demand. It was in Calorama, which is, you know,
yeah, just, great neighborhood.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so, you know, it was always easy to find renters. And albeit there were a couple changeovers, I never really had more than maybe 1 or 2 months of not having a tenant. And, you know, the rents kept rising despite the fact that, you know, everywhere else while I was overseas, you know, it was real estate was the worst thing to be in.
Yeah, gloom and doom across totally. The country. Yep.
So it was a really positive experience. And I think, you know, if that had not been in DC and had not stayed positive, I'm not sure if I would have been as interested in kind of dabbling in it in a more investment standpoint. So that was the positive thing that really drove the idea of what to buy when I came back. And I was also looking for a 2-unit at that time and trying to see if I could find a fee simple like row home in DC.
Nice.
And I think those were really some of the most competitive, you know, huge escalation
still
clauses.
Still are.
Mm-hmm. I mean, sometimes over 100,000 over asking. So, I mean, it was really difficult. And so ultimately, at the same time, my friend was also back looking for a place here in DC. And I think we even had considered offering on the same place, which, you know, outbidding each
great
other.
Great minds think alike, right?
Yeah. And so, but ultimately we decided, you know, with the success of this place in New Hampshire to kind of look to diversify and increase our purchasing power. And so we ended up partnering and were successful in a offer on a 2-unit property in Northwest that had actually originally been a 3-unit configuration. Mm. And so we started house hacking that place, you know, got a some renovations done in the basement and then got a tenant in there that covered probably almost two or maybe a third to almost a half of
a good
the mortgage.
Chunk. Yeah.
And so we lived there. I think I had gone and done another overseas assignment. I think he stayed throughout that period. But ultimately, we ended up...
So are you... I'm sorry to interrupt you. Are you both living in the house at this point? Because you mentioned you got a tenant also. So how are you splitting this up? Because I think a lot of people will be really interested in hearing how to partner with somebody else to buy real estate, right? Because most people are like, well, I don't have the money or, you know, it's really expensive. So it seems interesting that you partnered up with a colleague to actually buy places. How did that come about and how did that work out? I mean, are you both on the deed? Did you do an LLC? Like, how did you structure that partnership?
Sure. So that's some of the lessons learned specific to the LLC point that we can get into. But I think it worked out well because it started with this short-term rental and we were also, he's one of my best friends. And so
that helped.
Albeit there's
there. Mm-hmm.
Yep. And there's been times with friction, you know, I think you're going to have with any business partner, but
sure.
Ultimately I think he trusts me and I trust him. And so it has worked out very well, but I can see that it could be quicksand for some folks to dabble in with colleagues or family or friends. Mm-hmm. So I think I'm just lucky in that respect and maybe doubly lucky because as we'll get to, I actually brought in another great friend of mine that was a DAT in Dublin. And so together now we're all kind of doing this, but now much more formally under an LLC. And so this original one was kind of just, I guess, as a lawyer told me at one point, it's just a handshake partnership is the way that they consider it. And
is this the vacation rental then?
The vacation rental and then that first property in
DC. Okay, so just sort of a handshake. You're both on the deed and you just kind of work stuff out.
Correct. Yep. So tenants in common. So basically the right of survivorship to either individual if they were to pass away. We joke all the time that we need to do the actual partnership agreement. And at some point, we'll probably get to that.
Cart before the horse, right?
Yeah. So probably some danger there. But it's worked out great in terms of spread loading some of that risk and
sure.
In diversifying
also expense
multiple properties.
Too, right?
Oh, totally. Yeah.
Yeah. It's expensive. It's not cheap in DC.
Nope. So we rented the basement and then both lived in the upstairs. But I was only there for, I think, about a year. And then I went back overseas. And so he stayed in the property. And at that time, we started renovating the bathrooms. And then when I moved back roughly 2015 or so, we ended up doing a full renovation and reverting it back to its original 3-unit configuration.
Nice.
And so shortly thereafter, he actually went back overseas, a lot of coming and going, obviously, with the Foreign Service. And so at that point, you know, we had 2 of the 3 units rented. I was living in the third unit. And I actually looked at that point because I saw kind of the peak of some of the condo market and especially mm-hmm. rising HOA fees in this mm-hmm. this older building. It was a 1928 building that I had, that original 2006 condo. Mm. And so figured out that, you know, maybe I should get my equity out of that and was ultimately successful in buying my own 2-unit row home in DC, also in Northwest and Bloomingdale. And so ended up moving out and it was a bit of a like scramble to get a renter in my unit in order to be able to qualify for the loan for the new purchase, but was able to do that and quickly also renovated the basement of this new 2-unit. And
Stephen, you make it sound so easy. We're like, well, I just got a tenant, renovated the basement. You know, I'm sure it wasn't that simple, but
no, there was a bit of stress. I mean,
sure.
think, you know, I look back and I tell people all the time when, you know, your first house, you're signing those mortgage documents and it just seems overwhelming, like it's, the yeah. risk that you're walking mm-hmm. into. And I think when you consider that you're really holding equity or an asset, it's much easier to consider. I have to say that, like, I mean, this sounds almost terrible to say, but I sign mortgage documents now like it's nothing. Because the idea here is I already know, I run the numbers. If you really get into the numbers aspect, you know, especially if you're building in some buffers with capital expenditures and maintenance costs, that you really are in a good position with real estate if those numbers do look good. And so I think that trepidation kind of has long since dissipated. I try and look to be more risky, if anything, going forward in terms of some of these, because I think, you know, as the housing market continues to show that, you know, it's not necessarily an oversupply issue in, you know, risky lending, which was the case, you know, in that 2007-08 period.
Correct.
I think now we're really looking at still the opportunity of not necessarily great appreciation, but I mean, new construction is not going to keep up demand for the next, you know, in the foreseeable future. So I think
it hasn't been. Yeah. There's a gap in housing. There's not enough housing product for people who want it.
Yep. And we've seen that, especially in New Hampshire as well. And even the short-term rental market for vacation homes has shown, like, I mean, just a staggering appreciation over the last couple of years, just because everybody kind of with COVID has wanted to have that place to go to and also sees the benefit of having an investment or an income stream in terms of short-term rentals. So it's been great in that respect.
Actually, I'm curious about that. During COVID, obviously, probably initially demand dropped off for that vacation rental, right? I'm kind of curious, how did COVID affect that initial New Hampshire vacation rental?
It definitely dropped off a little bit. I think Airbnb was a little nervous about like what their liabilities would be or other of the booking engines. I don't actually know if it really hit us too much in the pocketbook, but I also went up there during parts of COVID and we're like doing some renovations for the bathrooms and some other cosmetic things. And so we actually took, or I took it because I think I was the only one domestic at the time, quite a bit of chunk of time to be up there just because it was also much more rural and, you know, it's better to be up there than in DC during some of COVID. So
for sure.
And then I think it actually, you know, as we see now, it spurred even a greater demand in some of those short-term rentals with people wanting to do it. And, you know, people felt comfortable in going in and renting their places and renting from others despite COVID. So it's, I would say it's definitely recovered, but it really wasn't much of a blip on the income stream.
Interesting. And how do you manage it? So you and your partner own it. And do you have like some duties divided between the two of you? And, you know, if somebody's overseas, for example, and like, neither one of you are in New Hampshire now, right? Like how easy is that to manage that short-term rental? Because we get a lot of questions about, well, you know, I'm in X country. I would like to do a short-term rental. How do you make that work not being there?
So I think, I mean, so we self-manage it just because it's one and it's pretty easy. But, you know, I have friends that manage multiple short-term rentals and they've recommended hospitality.com, which I think used to be Smart B&B. And there's a lot of services where if you get a good cleaner and like local person, it's still easy to self-manage those and kind of screen and ensure that the tenants that you're saying yes to are the ones that you want to say yes to. The fallback is we've engaged with a couple property management services that do short-term rentals. Their rates are pretty high. I think many start at 20%.
Yeah, I was just going to say 20% or higher.
Yeah, and then some are even up to 50%. Ooh. The property that we have in New Hampshire originally was associated with a hotel, like golf course. And so, for instance, I believe if it was in the hotel's rental pool, you may get more rents in terms of nightly rentals, but I think they were charging 50%.
Ouch.
So it's,
that's a lot.
I mean, even though it's turnkey, like, most of these, when you're getting up to that 40 or 50% are, you know, providing you the linens, the consumables, things like that. But, you know, it's definitely a big chunk of change in terms of your income. I think if you were able to find a great cleaner, and that's who we have, that really does like a little extra on the side that we compensate for is the best option until you're getting into like multiple short-term rentals.
So you're just managing like on an app or something like the guest communication. And really you just have one person on the ground, which is the cleaner that like comes in and does the turnover, the cleaning, lets you know if there's any supplies that are missing. Is that kind of how you have it structured?
Exactly.
Okay. And then you and your partner like kind of take turns with the app, or like how do you?
So I self-manage the property in DC just because I'm local, and he does the property in New Hampshire. And so we kind of split duties in that respect.
Ah, okay. That makes sense.
Yeah. I think doing it all on your own, especially when you're overseas with either a short-term or a long-term rental, can become challenging unless you've built a good network of people.
Good system. Mm-hmm.
And the network is the, for any of this real estate stuff, I think as soon as I started building, you know, whether it be handymen, contractors, cleaners, you know, that the two things that I would recommend to anybody considering this is concentrate on building a solid network that includes all of those things, plus the idea of real estate lending. But then the second idea there is considering all of the other resources that you have, especially in terms of financial analysis. There's tons of great websites out there now that kind of run the numbers and kind of quote unquote check your deals. I started with, you know, an Excel spreadsheet, and, you know, I would find errors every once in a while.
Yes.
And I still use that kind of a little bit, but I mean, some of these websites will do a much better job and much quicker to kind of see if a property is going to cash flow in a way that you need it to.
So at this point, you have sold your initial Calorama condo, right? You've got two properties that you own with a partner, right? Of the vacation rental in New Hampshire, and then the two, now three unit in DC, plus you've purchased another two unit in DC that you're living in. Then what happens next?
So basically, we saw the opportunity in New Hampshire. I'm actually trying to remember how we kind of considered this, but ultimately, we were talking to the same real estate agent that we bought this condo with years ago, now 10 plus years ago. And I think they were the ones that recommended, hey, have you considered, you know, other areas? And so we started looking at some of the MLS listings, and the numbers were just, I mean, spectacular. I think most of the cap rates are 10%, if not 15%, with multifamilies. And so ultimately, my friend, the original one that we own, the DC and New Hampshire properties with, bought a three unit. And then really predominantly over the last year, we've added, I think we are about to close on one this week. And so with that one, it'll bring a total of 27 units.
Excellent.
Spread between about, I think, five or six properties in New Hampshire. And, you know, the multi-units were definitely the way to go. You're getting in at, you know, $40,000 roughly a unit, 40 to upwards of 50, but 50 you want like something that's already kind of turnkey. And, you know, they're kind of a working class city. It is a fair amount of a Section 8 or housing assistance, but I mean, that's a steady income stream as well. And, you know, so you're looking at returns, you know, for a $40,000-$50,000 unit of almost $1,000 a month.
Wow.
And then
those are great numbers.
Oh yeah. You take away debt service and, you know, the property management fees and whatnot. I mean, you're still sometimes close to $300 a door, which by any standard is still pretty good. Mm-hmm.
Are these small multifamily, like 2 to 4 units? Are they commercial, like 5+ that you're looking at?
We have one that's 6 units that has some value add, so to speak, in terms of the ability to add additional units to spaces that are unrenovated. So that one was a commercial loan. We have a three units and 1 2 unit there in that area.
Okay. And then you mentioned you brought on a third partner, right? So then, you know, you went from sort of the handshake deal to did you start doing more formal things? At what point did you figure out like, okay, we should probably have something on paper? And then how did you structure that?
I wish I could say that I jumped to being smart and having something on paper, but in between
like
that,
you and me both, but we're all about action sometimes. We're like, look, it's a good deal. Let's just go do it. Right. And then you're like, well, we can figure out the paperwork eventually, you know, at some point. So.
Yeah, no. So that we did this is a great deal. Let's figure out the paperwork later. And I actually bought a 4 unit in Missouri where the third of my business partners lives after retiring from the Air Force. And so with that deal, you know, we were already looking at other properties in the Kansas City area. And kind of the three of us kind of talked, like, why don't we start looking at doing these things together? And so I think I was the glue between the two that didn't really know each other. Mm-hmm. But it's worked out, I mean, you know, quite well so far. I think the benefit there is that, you know, New Hampshire is somewhat local, you know, at least on the East Coast, and I'm definitely more familiar with the area. But then Sean, my other partner in Missouri, has the ability to be the local expert and the person kind of bringing together that team, as I mentioned, to expand into the Kansas City area as well.
And do you have those properties under property management, or is he managing them locally in Missouri?
So he's managing the one that we have. I think we've really looked at almost all of our new deals post that Missouri property are all managed by a management party. It's appetizing to see the numbers where you don't have to give anybody else the profit. But when you see that these tenants call you at all hours for whatever problem, and, you know, sometimes they're not necessarily taking care of the properties as the way you'd like them to, you see the benefit of, you know, that 10% going towards a property management firm and just not having to deal with those phone calls or texts at all hours. And I think going forward, although he manages the one in Missouri, I manage DC, and Matt, my other partner, manages New Hampshire. I think all the ones going forward, we're all in agreement that they need to be with a property management firm.
And I think you're at the scale too, where, you know, at some point it's a demand on your time, right? And in order to scale, you need good property management partners. And I would say for me, it's sort of the same, you know, piece. And I would also add that, you know, I think everybody thinks of the 3 a.m., you know, tenant and toilet call. But what they also don't remember too is that at tax time, you have to keep all of these receipts for like every little small thing. And the property management company also keeps all that paperwork in order for you as well, because at least for me, I'm terrible at paperwork, which my poor CPA knows, and my bookkeeper too. So, I mean, I think, you know, property management is a very key piece in the partnership.
No, totally. And I think this is the first year where, you know, we brought on a CPA and are filing under LLCs, and it is a learning experience as to the importance to being very strict with record keeping. I mean, I'm a fairly good numbers guy. And mm-hmm. I've been able to kind of keep my head above water, but I mean, just trying to meet the demands to file this year was eye-opening in terms of the need to use some things that I had not used previously, you know, like QuickBooks.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
I use a really good app called Stessa, which is owned by another company. I believe it's Roofstock, which does a lot of commercial real estate kind of wholesaling, so to speak. And though between those two, I think they provide a lot of the online tools to be able to, you know, do it as you go throughout the year and not feel inundated at the end of it. If you keep track of like where your costs are and link them to your accounts and everything.
Yeah, I think that's a really key point, because I think bookkeeping and the admin side is not very sexy. I mean, it's very nice to say, oh, I've got 27 properties and look at the buildings and look at the photos and look at all of these things. And then I go to my receipts that are all over the place and I think, well, I've got, you know, 20 Home Depot charges. I don't remember which unit is for which Home Depot charge and which project is this. So, you know, a note to our listeners out there, like a lot of people, you know, they'll get one or two or maybe three properties. But at some point, if you're doing this seriously, like Stephen and his partners are, I mean, you have to start the system, you know, sooner rather than later, because there is a big pain point that comes when all of a sudden you've expanded really rapidly and you're looking at tax time and you're under the gun to get things on time. And you're like, I have no idea which property this is for. And there are lots of receipts.
Yeah. I would offer to your viewers, I would start with your first investment property. Like,
agreed.
Even if you're just renting your home, I would go and check out Stessa in particular. It's a free kind of portal for tracking these things. And then also my recommendation would be to create specific business accounts. Now, they don't necessarily have to be a formal business checking account, but separate out everything into individual accounts will help you a lot. You know, even if you're using a different, you know, debit or credit card for multiple things at Home Depot, you at least know that, you know, your repairs, maintenance, or any type of expenses are always going to be allocated to the specific property. I think that's a huge thing that will help you not only in taxes, but just to see, you know, how your assets are performing.
Yeah, 100%. I would agree with that. And I had to hire a bookkeeper, as I may have mentioned once or twice before on the show, because it was my way of being accountable for every month. He would send me this spreadsheet saying, what are all of these charges, right? And on a monthly basis, you can actually remember what things are for. But like, if you're going a whole year and then you're like, oh, I need to do my taxes now, you're like, what is all of this? Like, and I'm not particularly organized about paperwork. I would much rather be out, you know, in the field, looking at property, running numbers and those kinds of things. So just some great tips there on keeping, you know, the books in order, because you can actually lose a lot of money too if you don't have those things in order, because you can't write them off or you can't find the receipt. And all that is, you know, really important at tax time.
No, and you mentioned it's not the sexy part of it, but
it isn't.
Myself,
it's not fun.
Yeah, I mean, I love going out and looking at deals, like what you know, touring them, running the numbers, even once you acquire them, you know, doing a lot of the sweat equity in the projects. But ultimately, the thing that probably is the best return on my time is the idea of the accounting and the numbers, because that really is what's going to make or break a deal. You can buy something that looks great, but if the numbers don't work, even however much sweat equity you put into it, it's potentially not going to be a great investment in the long term.
I think that's a really great point, Stephen, because I think too, even when you start with one property, people are like, oh, it's really profitable. And if you aren't looking at it like on a monthly basis too, maybe you aren't seeing things like, hey, the water bill's kind of high this month, or, you know, I didn't think about maybe this licensing fee. And I think if you just look at, oh, well, my mortgage payment is X and my rent is X, it's a very simplistic way of looking at it. And people are like, oh, well, the delta between those two is great. But then when you actually start to add up everything else that you're paying for, whether it's utilities or county licensing fees or property management fees, and you're really looking at the numbers, I find that at least beginning investors, you know, with their first couple of properties, until they do like a real sort of professional look at the numbers, are actually surprised that they're not making as much money as they think they are, right? And then also too, giving that to your accountant at tax time, the accountant can come back and say, look, you know, you can adjust these things here or there, maybe do like a cost segregation study to maybe reduce your taxes even more, right? There's lots of different things that you can do if you talk to your accountant early on in the process and get them involved also.
Nope, agree totally. And the one thing that we are instituting, especially after kind of seeing the pain of putting everything together for this year's taxes, is, as you mentioned, it's much easier on a monthly basis to remember what you actually did in the previous month.
Yep.
And so we're doing now a business meeting and trying to really take some skills that we may be doing at work and apply them in this side venture. And so meeting each month and going through all of the numbers and what were the expenses that we ran into, and that'll allow us to flag, you know, as you mentioned, you know, we found a tenant that had not transferred over their electricity when they moved in, and it took us 3 months to see why are we getting a separate bill from the local power company.
Yes.
And so I think staying on top of those things, you know, is definitely, again, where once you scale up is critically important.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And so at this point, you know, you've got your partnership with the three of you. It sounds like you're actively still looking for property to purchase. You said that you were closing on something recently. What sort of your look into the future in terms of, are you shifting your strategy at all? Is it still going to be small multifamily? You know, kind of what are you seeing in the markets that you're looking at right now in terms of changes or like how you're adjusting your investment strategy? Any tips?
I mean, I think ultimately what I'd like to get into is the idea of apartment syndications, you know, larger developments. But I think it's really difficult, especially still being kind of full time with the State Department. It's definitely can be done. There's tons of people that do it. I don't know if I've really heard of large apartment syndication kind of success stories within the Foreign Service, but there's definitely military members that have done it as they've moved around the country in assignments. I think that's my goal, is to see the idea of passive income as, you know, a core aspect of retirement, and looking at moving into that once I retire from the State Department, I think is my ultimate goal. I think before we get there, I think just building, as I mentioned, expanding into, you know, the Kansas City market. I have another good friend of mine that is a realtor and fireman out in Los Angeles. So I think it goes back to networking of business partners to find deals to spread load that effort, but also ultimately to bring other people's money to bear in terms of how to acquire deals. So I think that's my goal. I think in the short term, it's these properties in some of these smaller or even large cities that are, you know, Class C are great opportunities where, you know, you're not putting a lot of cash into them, but they're good appreciating and income producing assets. And so I think it'll probably be still looking at kind of that ideally 3 to probably 10 unit size, just because they're, again, much more easily pushed through, especially the commercial lending side, which is definitely more unique than many people are familiar with in terms of regular like debt to income discussions that they may have with their regular conforming lender. But once you get into the idea of commercial loans, you're looking at the global debt service ratios and how kind of everybody's finances comes together. But it's also really built on how the asset itself is performing.
And talk to us a little bit about that difference with commercial lending. So, you know, you're there with your two partners. How is that commercial lending experience different from the average, you know, like if you're getting a 30-year fixed residential loan?
Sure. I think maybe the best way to look at it is it's in many respects easier because you're dealing just with a bank and their loan officer, and they really look at the property and how it's performing. And so many of the actual steps are the same, but the difference is there's oftentimes a lot more flexibility with the commercial lenders versus the very strict process and all the requirements of a Fannie Mae or Freddie Mac loan, to include the idea of once you start doing this with multiple properties, as I think you've talked in other shows, you can only do 10 of the Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac loans. And that's actually compiled. Now, lenders may have a different interpretation, but those that I've talked to all seem to cap out that it's all of the parties that are in the deal count their Fannie Mae or Freddie Mac loans. And so if you have, you know, as has been the case with three people in multiple investments and or vacation homes or primary residences, you hit that number very, very quickly. And so your only option after that point is one of these commercial loans. And so I think to kind of round that out, the processes are for the most part the same. You're going to either get an evaluation versus an appraisal, and an evaluation is simply, I guess, a lower level appraiser. And so that's just making sure that the bank has a value in that property, just like any other kind of conforming loan would be. And outside of that, the rest of it's really all about the same outside of, you know, the steps to either purchase it directly into an LLC or quick claim or otherwise bring it into your existing business portfolio. I've only done a couple. And so I'm definitely still learning. I think the other big recommendation for people getting into this is, you know, buy books and read them from people that know. The Burr book by, I think, forget his first name, but Green.
David Green from Bigger Pockets.
Yep. Mm-hmm. So that's a great one. And there's tons of not only yours, but other podcasts out there if you're not a book person. But that one, or there's another podcast and a book, but it really is in depth about the apartment syndication idea. And so that's the best ever apartment syndication book by Joe Fairless. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So those two are great books to kind of talk about some of these processes in a lot more detail.
And the interesting thing is real estate investing is not the only area where you're investing, right? Talk to us about some of the other investments that you have and kind of how you're balancing that. I mean, you know, we're running a investor masterclass, and one of the questions we had during one of the classes was, you know, what percentage should real estate take up of your overall asset allocation, right? And I'm interested to hear kind of how you're balancing your real estate ventures with some of the other investing that you're doing.
What are you telling people? And then I can either lie or otherwise.
No, it wasn't me telling people. It was just a question mark, right? About, you know, what percentage does real estate make up of your portfolio? And, you know, we've had, I think, sort of just the general knowledge out there always says diversify, diversify, diversify. And my challenge to the class was, is that accurate advice for what you're trying to do, right? So like, for example, my portfolio, if you look at just the equity that I have in my real estate holdings is probably about 75 to 77% of my overall asset allocation, not just because I obviously have like retirement accounts, a TSP, cash. You know, I've got investments in multifamily syndications as well. And then I've got my real estate portfolio, but I'm very, very heavy in real estate. And, you know, I was asking, is that risky? And, you know, my personal philosophy is I don't think it is because I know my asset class really, really well. I think if you try to diversify in a bunch of stuff that you don't really understand too much, I think that's actually much riskier than if you've studied the market, you know your market, you know your asset class, you do well at it, you have a consistent track record, you know, you're getting good advice. It was a topic of discussion. It was not necessarily something that I was recommending. I was just asking people, where do you feel comfortable? You know, and is real estate a bigger part, a smaller part? You know, how do you feel about that versus stocks versus, you know, you've done some crypto investing, for example. So how do you kind of balance real estate with those other investments?
Sure. So I think my kind of retirement strategy, specifically the Foreign Service pension, is kind of my safe, secure investment. So I don't really do anything for the most part outside of poor attempts at gaming the market with TSP transfers, which have never been successful. I keep it all in S&C for the most part, because I consider that pension is a core aspect. And, you know, as any of your Foreign Service listeners know, I mean, it is quite a valuable aspect of retirement. I would say I probably have about 50%, and that's counting, if I was to break it down with the pension, about 50% in real estate.
Interesting.
So if I took out like the value of that pension, it's probably closer to yours, 60, 70% in real estate. And again, you know, nobody's going to make any more land. You know, even if Musk gets us to the moon, I don't really see that as an option for my own retirement. But the other things before you mentioned, I'll start off before I get to crypto. I do Fundrise, which is a real estate investment trust. It's a really kind of, it's not very liquid, but you know, it's a very well-performing investment where it gets your feet wet in real estate. You're not getting any of the tax benefits, but ultimately, a good performing investment, to get outside of just stocks.
What kind of returns are you getting in Fundrise, just out of curiosity?
Wow, I should have pulled that.
I was talking like 3%, 10%, just ballpark.
No, I think it's probably, it's right around 8%, I think.
Okay, so not too bad.
Yeah, and then they're offering, so they do have some where you're getting some of the ability to get some of the benefits of the real estate. I forget specifically, but they're doing basically an EIPO. I forget what they specifically call it, but that's a good one. I also use like a Wealthfront, which is like a robo investing tool that sometimes also outperforms stocks. And then I also have, you know, a financial advisor and money in just a 401k and a brokerage account that, you know, I kind of dabble in, but none of those are really anyway as successful or beneficial as the real estate stuff. The last one that I more recently got involved in over really the last year was crypto. I think back in 2018, I kicked myself every day at a barbecue. You know, one of my friends mentioned, you know, you should buy this thing called Ethereum and then Bitcoin and one other one. I think it was Litecoin at the time, and put, I think, $1,000 into it. And the crypto market had tanked for the next couple of years. And so it was kind of just like, why did I do this? And then I kind of really tried to start educating myself through podcasts and reading on crypto as kind of the future of technology. And it definitely sold me on investing in it. I think it's going to be a very roller coaster ride for the next couple of years. But the idea of what crypto can do, if you liken it to, you know, the early days of the internet, we hear of some of the protocols that we now just all believe in, TCIP, I think, I forget the specific one, you know, those were all competing. And I think in many respects, the idea of crypto is similar. It's a, you know, burgeoning technology that I think over time will kind of reduce down to a couple key cryptocurrencies that are really the way to use the blockchain, which is the underlying aspect of what cryptocurrency are. And so I probably have about 5% of my investments in terms of stock bonds in crypto at this point. But that also fluctuates. You know, last week it was probably 3%. So it's a wild ride. I think the term is HODL, hold on for dear life. And there are many other, and I'll have to find some of the folks that are even just in the DS world that know a lot more about crypto. They're the ones that you should probably interview to get that. Because I think it's, again, if you look at what some people view as like future potential values of some of these cryptos, especially the idea of Ethereum and Bitcoin, I mean, there's some appreciable returns that I think people can find. And there's huge amounts of large institutional investors that are buying these assets up, you know, in huge, we're talking about billions of dollars. And so I think the idea in my mind is I may not be that smart about it, but, you know, if Merrill Lynch and Charles Schwab and others are, you know,
getting on the bandwagon.
Yeah. I mean, mm-hmm. it can't be that dumb. But it could be. But again, it's you know, don't, it's like gambling, I would say. You know, it's like the saying is only gamble what you can afford to lose. And I think in this respect, that's still the way I look at crypto. Probably more of a gamble, but maybe a little bit better than blackjack or poker, since I'm not very good at poker.
And you know, the really interesting thing I think about foreign service investors is that, generally speaking, I've noticed that the foreign service tends to be fairly conservative, right? And actually, I mean, they're in a position where they could maybe take a little bit more risk than the average person because they've got a very secure job. You know, you've got the pension, you've got the TSP, you know, Social Security, all of these other things. So, you know, I like what you're doing is that you're taking a little bit of your portfolio and investing in things that, you know, could have a really outsized return, or maybe they might go bust, but you have that little play in your portfolio where you can, you know, experiment with some things. I don't tend to, just because I don't really understand crypto. So listeners, if you are out there and you know of somebody that you think would be great on the show, please, by all means, send them our way, because we would love to understand more about it. And I think there's, you know, there's definitely a demand to hear about crypto investing.
Yeah, I definitely would recommend the same. And there's a couple, The Modern Investor is a good podcast. He does like a daily one that kind of goes over what's happening in the crypto space. I think it's Coin99 on YouTube. I might have to double check that, but is also a great kind of introduction to crypto. So it goes over, you know, what is mining? What is actually like crypto currency? What is blockchain technology?
I think I need that, like the crypto for dummies video, because I'm just like, oh, I can't really wrap my head around it. So real estate, obviously brick and mortar makes sense to me. So that's where I'm at. So Stephen, you've done quite a few things, lots of investing. You know, what final tips do you have for your listeners? I feel like we could sit and chat all day. I feel like 40 minutes has just flown by, but any last words, parting thoughts?
Sure. I mean, I think the things that kind of in preparation and when we emailed back and forth that I would share is, you know, definitely just education is the key. But the best ever apartment syndication book, the Burr book, Rich Dad, Poor Dad. There are so many resources out there in the books and then podcasts. Yours is excellent. I mean, you just mentioned something that resonated with the idea of conservative foreign service investing. You know, I think you did a recent show with a financial advisor, and he talked about the idea that, you know, people approach him at like 56 and they're like
on the verge of retirement,
like, and I don't know if I can retire, and he's like, you should have retired 6 years ago. It's like
or gone on more trips, yeah, or done more fun things, right?
Yeah, it's all about enjoying life. I mean, at the end of the day, you know, we you know, are here one time, and so make the most of it. And so I think those podcasts, the books, tons of online resources, happy to share them. And if you want to post them somewhere, but there's tons,
yeah, sure,
of ways to not only manage the numbers that we talked about, but also find deals. There's even ways to, you invest. I think I mentioned one of them is Roofstock. Like, you can go on and almost like eBay, like click a house and buy it almost immediately. And there are many turnkey options on there. So there's tons of resources out there. So I think it's just kind of taking the leap into the pool. Like, there's a lot of water and it's pretty deep. So jump in. Worst case scenario, you can just walk out and probably not even in this market lose much money. So I think that the key is just risk tolerance. You know, figuring out that you're buying something that, you know, they're not going to make much more of, and you have a huge insurance policy, so you don't have a lot of risks. And I don't say that like flippantly. I think, as I think you would probably attest, real estate is probably one of the safer options. You know, they can always make more cryptocurrencies or more companies on the stock exchange, but you can't really make many more pieces of land out there, especially if it's in a valuable location. So, you know, the same things of when you buy something, you know, I always tell people that are first buying a house, like when I first bought my condo or another place, ultimately, when you walk in, you should feel in love with the place. And if you have that feeling, then it's probably a good idea. And I add, when it's investing, that you should walk in and love this place because it looks good, but also because the numbers are good, and you're probably not going to go wrong. I mean, watch the housing market collapse next week. But
there you have it, folks. Stephen Marquette. Stephen, it's been great having you on the show today. And I would just make one last comment, which is I find that, you know, DS agents really are doing well in the investment world. It's funny because I've talked to so many people in DS, and I do think that there is something to it, in the sense that, you know, when people are a little more conservative, or if they take risks, right, that is really what differentiates how your investment portfolio is going to end up, right? So going back to what William Carrington was mentioning on some of his other podcasts, he and I have had conversations offline. And one of the things that he's looked at and has seen studies at is really, you know, the risks that people take and how that translates into how big their portfolio or their investments grow, right? And so I think if you kind of do the traditional things, you end up kind of the traditional route with sort of the traditional amount. But if you take big steps, you know, investing with partners, you know, investing in 27 units in multiple states, trying crypto, doing these other things. There are people that are doing all of these things very successfully. And as Stephen mentions, you know, there's a ton of education out there. Find something that works for you and try it, right? And build on it and get better at it and be really good at it. And I think that's, you know, the way to go. So Stephen, thanks so much for being on the show today, and best of luck with your investing with your partners.
Thanks. And same to you and everybody out there listening. Good luck.
If you like this episode and want more, make sure to give us 5 stars on the podcast player of your choice. And after that, check out our Facebook page. From there, you can learn about our other episodes, connect with our guests, and of course, share your own ideas for success. We'll see you next time.